Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Betsy Keller. Dr. Keller is a professor in the Department of Exercise and Sport Sciences at Ithaca College. Prior to her appointment at IC, she was on the faculty of Syracuse University and Smith College. Her research has been focused on physical activity and health in children and older adults, as well as childhood obesity and chronic fatigue syndrome. Keller is also primary or co-author of numerous national and international presentations and publications. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what started your interest in sports sciences and health and nutrition to tell us?
Good question. I really have to think back to why I ended up doing this, but I've always been a physically active individual. And I think early on, even when I remember back into high school, I was concerned about, at that time, some of the trends we were seeing in terms of the development of the fast food industry in our country and what that might mean for us down the road. And we were already seeing the effects of it here in this country. And then I began thinking about, well, what is this going to mean internationally, for example? What is this going to mean when these companies head overseas? And in fact, what we've seen is the same kind of trending happening in the countries where all of these fast food chains have emerged as well. And then being the physically active person I am, it just sort of became a good marriage for me to learn more about how this affects our health and our well-being as we age. And even in our younger years, how does that translate to the aging process and how does it impact us?
Yeah, it's a really important issue and it certainly is on the table right now. Well, let's talk a little bit about one of your areas of research, and that is childhood obesity. Now, obviously the trend has been on an uptick since I was a kid in the 1960s. To tell us what you found.
Well, I've done a lot of reading in this area, and there are a lot of factors involved in this, certainly. But we tend to get lost in all of the variables that can contribute to why children and adults are overfat and why that trending is continuing in a really alarming way. My interest really was to try to boil it down into some meaningful message that every person can do something about in some meaningful way. And as I look at it, we can look at the incidence of technology and the use of technology amongst kids. We can look at fast food offerings. We can look at the decrease in funding in schools that has driven them to back off on the amount of minutes that are offered for physical activity, for recess and physical education. We can look at all of those factors. But ultimately, we have to really take responsibility for what we're able to do to try to mitigate that. And so I started looking at more of the role of the parent and how they can better mitigate what's going on with their kids in terms of physical inactivity and their food behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And the culture has changed so much. I mean, so many parents are gone all day. They come rushing home, have to put something on the table, and so they reach for fast food or already prepared foods. It almost looks like we have to change the culture in some way.
And that's tough because I don't need to tell you about the economy today, but we certainly have more families with both parents working. So time, by all accounts, is a huge factor in being able to offer a healthful table at dinner time and also to be physically active with your kids. But that doesn't mean that we should, you know, stray from those responsibilities. And to what extent we can be certain that the food offerings, for example, that are available to our kids are helpful food offerings, we need to do that. That doesn't necessarily need to translate into expensive food
or time-consuming.
Kids generally, you know, they come in after school. Whatever they see is what they're going to grab. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they're going to grab to eat because they're starving. And if what you make available to them is a healthful treat, you know, even carrots to munch on or apples or simple treats, that's fine. Yeah. It doesn't need to be anything elaborate.
Yeah. In recent years, people as well as the government have gotten into the school lunch issue and tried to make those more healthy. How do you think that's going? Is it working? Because I hear kids throw away stuff they don't want to eat. They don't want the vegetables, in other words, you know?
Yeah, that's always an issue, and kids will always do that, frankly. I mean, if you think about your own growing up years where you like something and you didn't like something. And part of that also, again, I'm going to take that back to the family and back to those behaviors that I always disagreed with when I was a kid, which was you can learn to like food. Mm. And quite some time ago, Newsweek had a very interesting article, and it was a cover page. It was the cover story, and I can't tell you what year it was, but it was about fat children, things, factors that were contributing to it, and they listed a bunch of what I'll call factoids. And one of the things that they mentioned at the time was that children have to be introduced to a food item of some sort 15 to 18 times before they'll integrate it into their food repertoire, uh-huh. and that the average parent will introduce it 2 to 3 times, and if the kid still gives them a hard time, they won't do it again, and they'll defer to the child's preferences. And I spent many, many hours in front of plates of food when I was a kid, but consequently, I eat a lot of varied foods as well for that reason. And so I think that's important that, A, from the family perspective, that we teach kids to eat a variety of foods, and then also when they're offered up in the school setting, then they would be less inclined to do that. But that said, the attempts to bring better foods, healthier foods, fruits, vegetables, clean proteins into the school setting is having some success. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to continue to do that because the school lunch program was dominated many years and dictated in many ways by economics and by cheap food.
Yeah, and corporations would give people deals.
Corporate influence and deals to bring their foods and drinks into the school
setting.
Exactly, because they had a captive audience there. And so mitigating that is also very important as well. And I think that these programs, one is spearheaded by Michelle Obama, the Let's Move program, and it's a big part of that program to try to get schools to become healthier environments for the kids.
And do you think schools should play more of a part? Do they still teach kids about health and nutrition? I mean, when I was a kid, we used to have to take classes like that in Southern California. I don't know if they do that anymore. It seems like kids also need to have role models in schools.
They need to have role models in schools. Most importantly, they need to have role models at home. And we know that because while there's a meal eaten in school every school day, there are many meals eaten at home. Mm-hmm. And so having role models in both environments is extremely important. And there is education going on in the schools about it, but that doesn't, you know, putting those notions to practice is another story. And then having somebody reinforce those practices is really important, which is why what's happening at home is incredibly important, especially for young children where those eating behaviors are established early on and they carry through life. We all have our own comfort foods that we like, however healthy or unhealthy they are. I am a chocoholic, and I will say that on the radio.
But people are influenced by what their mothers eat. I mean, my mother was into exploring all kinds of different foods, and my father wasn't. And consequently, I'll eat almost or try almost anything.
Exactly.
So I didn't follow my father's route. I followed my mother's route, you know.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. And that's a great example. And both of my parents decided early on that we were going to sit in front of plates of food until we ate them. Now, the downside of that is forcing a child to eat beyond their comfort level is not what you want to do, too. And I do have to overcome my propensity to always want to clean my plate. But I did learn to eat a variety of foods. And they persevered. They were the 15 to 18 times you will see this food over and over again kind of parenting. And it does make a difference. And again, that brings it back to the family, though.
Yeah.
That's hard work.
It is hard work when you've got
a kid who says, oh, you can't make me do this, and you can't make me learn to like something I don't like.
Yeah, and you almost have to start from scratch. Some mothers do, because they hate a lot of foods. They learn that from their... It's a vicious cycle sometimes. That's why I was thinking that the school could come in and take over the role model version of exploring, you know, trying new foods.
And the problem with that, though, is there is no one who's going to sit there and say, you really need to eat this lunch. Yeah. And if they throw it out and they go hungry the rest of the day, then A, we know that that can affect their academic performance, and B, they're going to go home and eat whatever they can grab when they get home.
Yeah. Exactly. So let's talk about the health ramifications of obesity that we've been seeing. I mean, kids are getting diabetes, high blood pressure. We never used to see that in young kids, at least not when I was growing up. It was always grandfather who would get those kinds of diseases, or grandmother, you know?
It's alarming. It's truly alarming. It's scary. And we have the first generation of children who are slated to predecease their parents.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's unheard of. Maybe back in prehistoric times, you know, mom or dad got taken down by a big cat or something. But in this day and age, it's alarming.
And we can attribute it directly to obesity and bad diet, right? I mean, for the most part?
Obesity, physical inactivity, and unhealthy eating behaviors. And as I said at the beginning, there are a lot of other things that are impacting why this is happening, but when it comes right down to it, those are the two things that we have some control over and we can do something about. And what we do know is that parents are the most important model for eating behaviors and physical activity in kids' lives. They are the most important. And mom is probably, especially in the traditional home, mom is probably the most important model for that. So if you have an active mom, you're more likely to have an active kid. If you have a mom who's eating more and varied foods, as you pointed out, it's more likely that the child will do that as well.
Yeah.
And so they're hugely important models in lives of children.
Mm-hmm. You know, the statistic that really kills me is that 80% of obese children become obese adults. Is that true? I read that.
That is very true, and it just speaks loudly to the challenge of dealing with adult obesity. Adult obesity is a hugely challenging issue to overcome, and when a child becomes obese, you have set them up for that path.
Yeah.
And it's not insurmountable, so I don't want it to sound like it's doom and gloom, but it's incredibly challenging. That is a very accurate statistic.
Yeah, and you see it. I mean, you see evidence of it. You see, you know, obese mothers with little kids who are already way overweight. You see it all over the culture.
And I think this is a good point to make that, you know, we can blame that on genetics if we want to. We can blame that on our parents. You know, they do bear responsibility for this because they're feeding the child and they're modeling or failing to model physical activity as well. And so those things are set up very early in life. But how much of a role does genetics play in this whole thing?
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is that metabolic dysfunction that contributes to the development of obesity is really small. We know much, much more about the biochemistry of obesity than we've ever known before. And in studying that, and because those kinds of articles and those studies tend to make it into the lay media and the lay journals and newspapers, we kind of think, oh, that's the excuse.
Yeah.
That's why this is happening.
Yeah.
But in fact, the incidence of obesity 50 years ago, 60 years ago, was far smaller than it is today. So our genetics hasn't changed in less than a generation.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Or a couple of generations.
Uh-huh.
So those true metabolic disorders account for a very small incidence of obesity. Does it mean that some people are a little bit more resistant to losing fat or gaining fat than others? No, that's true.
Yeah.
But we still have to acknowledge and deal with our own balance point of gaining and losing fat and how much food we need to keep our bodies healthy and working well and how much is too much.
Yeah, and then you get into psychological stuff. You know, how much is food being used for sadness or for heartbreak or, you know, for loneliness?
And in many cases, that's probably the root cause of most obesity. And dealing with the behaviors underlying why we put food in our mouths when we're not hungry.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Betsy Keller. She's a professor in the Department of Exercise and Sports Sciences at Ithaca College. You know, I want to ask you, too, there's been a lot in the news about the nanny state that's happening here in New York with Bloomberg trying to get rid of giant drinks and outlawing them in certain places. What do you think about that?
I think you can't legislate everything. And I understand the attempt to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just having the dialogue about should he do that or should we go there or not, it, you know, brings it to the forefront and makes people talk about it and maybe makes people sort of open their eyes and realize, do I really need 64 ounces of a carbonated beverage? You know, it is unbelievable and it's amazing. And it's certainly, you know, we know that the consumption of soda is now three times the consumption of water. for most individuals in this country.
Yeah, and I don't think people realize how much fat and sugar is in that. I mean, not fat, but sugar.
Sugar. It's they're hugely sugary, you know, not to mention the tooth decay and everything else that goes along with it, but how it contributes to the development of diabetes and obesity as well. Mm-hmm. And that 40, 50 years ago, the consumption of milk used to be twice the consumption of these other products. So this is huge that we're drinking this much. I'm not convinced that legislating the outlawing these large drinks is the way to go. I'm an advocate of going to the root of the cause. And the root of the cause begins back in those early formative years. Mm-hmm. And we need to go back, and I would love to see us pour our money into working with parents who are having kids and, you know, having their first child, and working with them in terms of what we need to be doing as far as healthy eating behaviors and modeling physical activity, recognizing our kids when they're obese and then doing something about it, and also helping to create an environment where fruits and vegetables and clean proteins are accessible to all socioeconomic levels of individuals, because fruits and vegetables, they're expensive, and they've gotten increasingly expensive.
Yeah.
And so that accessibility is a problem. Having some of these discount grocery stores, we sort of have a grocery store war going on in Ithaca, and we do have some discount grocers where you can actually go buy fruits and vegetables and protein at a much reduced cost if that's a major concern for you, and that is for most of us.
Yeah, and also the farmers markets, the propensity, but not everybody can find access to that, especially in the poorer neighborhoods, you know, the food deserts that I've had guests talking about. Now, I want to ask you this too. How does a parent with great intentions, wonderful habits that they're trying to get their kids to carry on, fight the culture that is bombarding kids with ads for cereals? And I mean, how do you navigate that?
Great question, and you know,
no answer, right?
No, well, if we started out with, you know, just let's talk for a second about technology and children and the use of technology. Children are currently spending, on average, 8 to 9 hours per day of screen time.
Wow.
So screen time is, and it's probably, those data are a little bit old. They're a couple of years old, so it's probably even greater than that now, and that's from the Kaiser Family Foundation research. But 8 to 9 hours per day of screen time, so that's the computer, that's the television, in addition to going to school. So it's excessive, and if you're spending time in front of a screen, then you're spending time not being physically active as well. So using the screen less means that you're probably going to be less inundated with these food ads and these, you know, various media attempts to get us to buy the latest cookie or the latest cereal or the latest whatever.
It's absolutely inundated.
It does bombard all of us, and getting your kids to learn it. Talking with your kids about it is the first and foremost thing that we should do, about how to interpret these ads, whether they should pay attention to these ads or not. And we have to monitor it to some extent. And it is difficult, I do acknowledge it, because everyone's busy.
Well, we even have corporations sponsoring schools now. They have their ads in schools and their Coke machines. And I was absolutely aghast when that started happening a while back.
Yeah, and you know, dealing with that in terms of schools and schools getting money from these corporations, that's something that can be done, you know, in a very effective way to try to get some of the, you know, soda offerings out of the school setting.
Mm-hmm.
Or changing what is offered in the soda machine, and getting the carbonated sugary beverages out and offering more healthful alternatives in those machines.
Yeah. Now, you've done a lot of research on fitness and physical activity. What does that mean to an older adult? You talk about elders and children being physically active. How does that help their lives, even if they do have a tendency to be a little bit overweight?
We know that being physically active, and I want to use that term instead of exercise, because I think we kind of, in my field, we kind of shot ourselves in the foot when we started to push exercise on everybody. It's a term that scared people, frankly.
Yeah.
And we also spent a lot of time getting very specific and detailed about what you should and shouldn't do. And I think that scared a lot of people and overwhelmed them.
Mm-hmm.
And so being physically active is not a difficult thing to do. Everybody's capable of doing it in their own way. And what we know is that simply being physically active versus sitting on the couch will improve your health status profile. So getting off the couch and moving around versus sitting on the couch will make a difference in your overall health. Will it prepare you to run a 5K race? No, it won't. But it will improve those variables that we look at that say, how healthy are you, that tell us that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't take much to go from being unhealthy to more healthy,
mm-hmm,
in terms of your weight status, your blood lipid profile or the fats in your blood,
your blood pressure,
your blood pressure, mm-hmm, your blood glucose levels, all of these things that when they go up, they signal the beginning of disease process, and we are seeing those disease processes going on in our children. As you pointed out earlier, we used to see them going on in older adults,
yeah,
and now we do see them in the children.
Yeah,
as well.
I like the way they're not telling people they have to have 30 minutes, you know, 4 or 5 times a week, because that does scare people. Now they're telling people to just get up from their desks and stand up, or stand up to read a book, or, you know, I mean, stand up to, you know, whatever. And you can do that in the office too, right?
Exactly. And I think my field sort of recognized this a few years ago, and they said, look, we need to, you know, we need to stop preaching to the choir here. We need to preach to all those people who represent that trending in obesity. We need to get them off the couch. That's who we need to speak to. So simply getting up and moving around, standing versus sitting, will burn more calories.
Yeah, yeah.
Moving, you know, taking a meeting and walking with your meeting partner instead of sitting in an office, or talking on the phone and walking around instead of sitting in the chair. And there's been a lot of interesting research that's been done on looking at the energy cost or the energy expenditure associated with physical inactivity compared to what I call non-purposeful physical activity.
Mm.
That means you're not necessarily going out to run or jog or play tennis, but just moving your body around, walking from the car into the grocery store, or walking around your building and taking the stairs, or even just fidgeting. You burn more calories if you're a fidgeter than if you're a non-fidgeter.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really simple to burn a few more calories every day by just not sitting down.
Yeah. And people forget that what huge energy it takes just to move around. You know, you're moving your blood and your muscles, and just to walk across a room. When you think about somebody who's paralyzed, how they can become so unhealthy because they can't move at all.
Exactly. And, you know, our bodies were designed a long time ago, well before computers. I'm pretty confident about that. And the thing about the body is that it was designed with movement in mind. So blood flows back up from our toes to our heart because we have muscles pumping it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the muscles aren't contracting, for example, while we're walking, then the blood tends to pool more, and it doesn't get back up to our heart,
yeah,
and then move from our heart to our lungs, where we get rid of our carbon dioxide and we take in new oxygen to then bring down to the muscles for more muscle activity. And so that right there, just in terms of your circulation, can create a problem.
Yeah.
But our bones and our connective tissue, our ligaments and our tendons, rely on stress to stay healthy and to get healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So while, especially if you've broken a leg or done something like that, you know how difficult it is to get back using that limb again and getting it back to full function.
Mm-hmm.
But it's possible, and the only thing that does it is activity.
Yeah.
And our bones stay strong because we stress them. We have to compress them. We have to torque them in a healthful way, not overdo it and then we break it, but in a healthful way.
Yeah.
And that helps to actually make the bones stronger and the ligaments and the tendons too. So our bodies were designed with movement in mind, and that's what keeps them working. And when we choose not to move, which is very easy to do in this day and age because we have so much tech to support sedentary lifestyles,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
it's really easy to lose your physical function.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Now, let's go back to Michelle Obama's initiative that she has started since becoming First Lady. Do you think it's made a difference, her get up and move and nutrition and you know, gardening and fresh food?
Well, that's a good question. If you go to the website, the program website is letsmove.gov. And if you go to that website, you'll see that there are resources for sort of the everyday individual person in terms of providing exercise guidance, older individuals, younger individuals, and also there are resources for the schools and an initiative to encourage schools to buy in to a program that includes offering a better assortment of healthier foods, fruits, vegetables, and increasing physical activity. So in a sense, it's kind of like creating a contract with that school that you will do this to help improve the overall health status of our children.
Mm-hmm.
So schools are doing that, and certainly choosing to use their funding in a way that focuses on those initiatives is an important piece of being able to do to improve their healthy food options and offer physical activity for their children.
Yeah.
Because we know children spend about, you know, roughly, and this is an estimate, roughly 50% of their movement is happening during the school day. And so if you take that opportunity away from them, then you've just reduced their opportunity to move those bodies around.
Yeah. And I think anybody who has the bully pulpit, like a president or even a politician, and uses it in that way, it's going to make a difference. I mean, people pay attention to people in authority, it seems to me. So, I mean, if you're saying something good, it might trickle down. Well, what do you think about the local food movement that's going on in different parts of this country?
I think that, especially in this community, we've done a pretty impressive job of trying to sensitize people to local food, regional food, keeping things local in terms of the carbon footprint that eating mm-hmm. outside of our locality imposes. And you know, we're a pretty sensitive community to that. And I think, along with Michelle Obama's efforts through Let's Move, if you look on that website again, you'll see guidelines about creating a garden and making your food right there more local for yourself.
And I've heard kids are more interested if they can cook their own food and watch it grow.
Watching it grow is really exciting for kids to see that they put forth the effort and then something came of it and now it's on their plate. It's very exciting for them.
So you know, we only have about a minute left. You feel hope for being able to deal with this obesity epidemic or what?
I do feel hopeful. You have to feel hopeful. But it's tough. It's very tough, and it really does require parental accountability to make those hard decisions and to hold the line with those kids who, as we know, you know, they're no, pull into this fast food, pull into McDonald's, pull into here. This is in the convenience and everything. It's not convenient to be a tough parent and hold the line with these really important behaviors that we need to instill in kids early on. That's tough. And, you know, for parents to dial back their activity level and refocus is something that I think we need to find ways to support, to be able to help them realize how important this is and that this is where the energy needs to go first and foremost to get at this obesity epidemic.
Well, Betsy Keller, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, we've been talking to Betsy Keller. She's a professor in the Department of Exercise and Sports Sciences at Ithaca College. Thank you.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.